from bureaus worldwide, this is FSR.
Thanks very much, Ollie in Brussels there. What a day it's been in Greater Manchester. Scorching day, temperatures in the mid-20s, but feels much warmer than that. Welcome to a Wednesday's Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, triggerwarning.tv, my own website, of course, and many other platforms as well. It is always brilliant to be with you. Two brilliant guests on the programme today. Looking forward to hearing from them.
Richie Allen.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Well, Tony Gosling is the presenter of the politics show on BCFM in Bristol. It's a brilliant program. Tony's a great journalist and more besides. He joins the program this hour. We've lots to talk about. We're going to round up the biggest stories of the week thus far, Tony and myself. And in the second hour, winging in live from Wisconsin, my old friend Dr. Kevin Barrett, academic, author, theologian, broadcaster. Lots you could say about Kevin. Been ages. He's been in Malaysia recently. We'll talk about that and much more besides with Kevin Barrett. He's back on the programme in the second hour. As usual, if you'd like to contact me directly, you can do so by tweeting me. It's at Richie Allen Show. That is the Twitter handle. It is Europe's most listened to independent radio show, broadcasting live from Salford in Greater Manchester. Yes, it's a dirty old town. Not so dirty today, it's lovely actually. It's lovely because it's bathed in sunshine. Sunshine! I told you, all my accents sound the same. In my head, I think I sound like my friend Tez. But I know when I listen back, it's rather embarrassing. Thanks to Vicky Haig for coming back on this programme last night, what a woman. I was inundated today with messages from people, and this goes to show how many people arrive at this radio programme that have never heard of many of the conspiracies we investigate. Because I was inundated by people who could not believe that the Lord Justice of Appeal and the Investigatory Powers Commissioner of the UK today, a man called Sir Adrian Bruce Fulford, Lord Fulford, was a founder member of PI, the Paedophile Information Exchange, a man who once campaigned to lower the age of consent to 4. And I was staggered at the amount of people who got in touch with me today through various channels to say, Richie, what's going on? Yeah, what is going on? Is the question. Vodafone has switched on 5G in 7 UK cities today, including Manchester, Cardiff, London, Manchester, Glasgow, Birmingham. As far as I know. Not a whisper on the BBC today about the concerns expressed about the health problems that will inevitably follow the rollout of 5G. Not a whisper. It's all brilliant, said the BBC today. Wonderful! No health even impact survey, none. Nothing. Just rolled out, just switched on. The consequences are going to be massive, we know this. 180 scientists and doctors from 36 countries have written to the European Union, you know this because I told you this some weeks ago, demanding that there's an inquest and inquiry into the effects of electromagnetic radiation. Nothing from the European Union either. Incredible, very important stuff, right? Right. Kind of a health-based monologue today. Jeremy Hunt, the Foreign Secretary, has challenged Boris Johnson, his rival, for the leadership and, well, basically, his rival for the job of Prime Minister. He's asked Johnson to explain his plan for tackling obesity. And he said to Johnson, stop offering populist pledges. Why is he saying that? Because Johnson, Boris Johnson, said that he's going to halt what are known as thin taxes. These are taxes on salty, sugary and fatty foods. Johnson says, well, well, let's have a moratorium on these taxes. A populist pronouncement by Boris Johnson, the former Foreign Secretary. What did Johnson say? What did he say? What did he say? I'm having one of those weeks. I'm forgetting to do something as basic as lift the correct fader. And here was me this morning bragging about the quality of the Richie Allen Show. I know, irony, children. Here's Boris Johnson. What did he say about syntaxes? Here he is.
Obesity is a huge public health challenge, probably now our number one public health challenge. It costs the NHS absolutely billions. We've got to deal with obesity, but we've got to do it in a way that is evidence-based. And what I want to see is evidence, actual evidence, that new taxes on this or that item of food and taxes which fall disproportionately on poorer families actually stop people from being so fat.
Stop people from being so fat. He's a great way with words, doesn't he, Bojo? You know, aren't they, and when I say they, it's the royal they. Every one of them, including the bearded wonder in Islington, aren't they a shower of effing lawyers and hypocrites, aren't they? Why do I say that? Well, Matt Hancock is the health secretary. Until today, Matt Hancock, the health secretary, was a massive fan of taxing sugary drinks and crisps and I don't know, Cocoa Pops and KP Choc Dips and all the rest of it. So the health secretary was a big fan of taxing all this stuff. But now, because he's supporting Boris Johnson's leadership campaign, we had a big flip-flop. Here's Matt Hancock.
I strongly support having an evidence-based review into how the how these taxes are working. And
but that's not what you said a few weeks ago with Dame Sally Davies, I think. You said it was a brilliant idea. Tax all the sugary stuff. Tax all the salty stuff, you said. Come on, Matt.
After all, there's of course the tax, but there's more ways that we can make sure that we tackle obesity.
How do we do it? How do we tackle obesity?
And Boris himself is a great...
Boris himself is a big, huge, fat bastard. What do we do about it?
...example of how we can all get fit and svelte by without the need for the nanny state, by getting on and doing more exercise and cycling to work.
Hang on a second. Boris is a great example of somebody who had a bit of discipline for a few weeks, lost a few pounds, but then got tired of it and put on the weight he'd lost and then some. This is politics, you see. It sounds like a very small story, this, but it's a wonderful example of how wretched these creatures really are. Hancock, all for the taxation of the sugary drinks and all the rest of it, but not now because, well, he's Bojo's pal. Matt Hancock, eh? I asked Gene Wilder, Gene, what would you say to Matt Hancock?
You stupid, ignorant son of a bitch, dumb bastard!
Yes.
Jesus Christ, I've met some dumb bastards in my time, but you outdo them all.
He outdoes them all! Unbelievable. Quickest flip-flop in political history. Only took a couple of weeks. So Jeremy Hunt, the former health secretary, he's today's foreign secretary, and he's Johnson's opponent, in the leadership contest, what did Jeremy Hunt say?
Well, I'm totally confused about what Boris's policy is on this, because he's saying he doesn't want these sin taxes, but he's got Matt Hancock, the health secretary, in his team who strongly supports them. So I think consistency really does matter. We have an obesity epidemic. We have the second highest number of obese young people anywhere in Europe.
We do, but it's not just down to the food. It must be said. I like David Stanford's tweet. Any excuse for a bit more tax, Richie? A bit more misery to the poor. How about a Rolls-Royce or Corgi shit tax, eh? Yes, I would certainly vote for a Corgi shit tax. There is no more worthless, wretched canine than a Corgi. And I love dogs. I love them. Not fond of Dachshunds, to be honest. What else am I not fond of? I'm not fond of Labradoodles and these kind of mash-up dogs they've got now. These mash-up dogs, these sexy, cool celebrity dogs. I don't like them either. I don't like anything today. I'm having one of those bloody days. It's very warm here. In studio, it's very warm. I don't know what that was meant to be either. All my accents sound the same. Paul says if Bojo wants to tackle obesity, he can start with his fucking face. Yes. Good stuff. You could wire their jaws together. And Murray says you could always stitch their lips together. Bit of wired jaws. Didn't they used to do that at one time? Not just for people who shattered their faces in accidents, but they used to wire people's jaws together. Here's a very big story, very important, 13 minutes past the hour. Doctors are not prescribing medicinal cannabis due to a lack of clinical trials. At least, that's according to The Guardian. Okay? The Commons Health Committee has warned that patients' expectations are being disappointed. Why? Well, medicinal cannabis was legalised in this country back in November, but people can't get it. That's November. Put your fingers out now, dear listener, because if you're as thick as I am, and I can be very thick, I've got to count on my fingers. You do that as well. Do it with me now. November, December, January, February, March, April, May, June, July. 8 months ago, they legalised it, but people can't get it. Why can't people get it? Why? What's going on? Why legalise and then not prescribe? Well, well, well. Kay Burley, the ginger ninja. The ginger ninja. Spoke to a guy called Robin Emerson today. My listeners who pay special attention to health news items or health matters will know who Robin Emerson is. He's got a 3-year-old daughter called Georgia. And Georgia has severe epilepsy, which has been eased by cannabis oil. Now, when Kay Burley speaks to him, she incorrectly states that medicinal cannabis hasn't been cleared by NICE, N-I-C-E, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. NICE provides national guidance and advice to improve health and social care. And Kay thinks, and it's an innocent mistake now, Kay thinks that NICE hasn't issued guidelines on it, therefore that's why it isn't being prescribed, despite the fact it was legalised 8 months ago. Here's Kay speaking with Robin Emerson.
Robin Emerson, he has a little girl. She is 3 years old.
Georgia, yeah.
Georgia, she has severe epilepsy. She was the first patient in the UK to get a prescription when the law changed allowing medicinal cannabis. Hi, how are you? Nice to see you again. Thanks for coming in. Talk to us about where we are with this. It's not on the NICE guidelines, which basically has to be in order to be able to get it by the NHS. Is that right?
No, it's actually, that's where it's false, because that's where people believed that a medication has to be on the NICE guidelines in order to be prescribed by the NHS. That's actually incorrect. Okay. In the UK, we use lots of unlicensed medications. George is on others that are prescribed by the NHS that are unlicensed. Chlorohydrate, a medication with no trials have ever been done anywhere for it to be used as an antileptic medication, yet it is. So whenever that's been pushed out a lot, and I think wrongly been pushed to the media as believing that this is what has to be the case in the UK, and the public believe that all medication goes through trials and goes through all the systems. That's wrong. Okay. That isn't what's happened.
Okay.
And, you know, there's really nothing prohibiting medical cannabis being prescribed.
So why do you think it is?
Why do you think it is? That's a good question, Kay, because he gave an excellent answer there. Why is it not being prescribed? Back to Robin Emerson.
That's a good question, Kay. I honestly think that there's, you know, it's becoming apparent, is there something more sinister behind the scenes here? Because we're now 8 months in to when this was legalised.
I remember.
And, you know, Sajid stood up and he said that this would be, he's seen that children needed it, adults needed it. Children were dying without access to this. And yet we're 8 months in and not a single NHS prescription has been written outside of the two that were original, the Alfie Dingley case.
So what's sinister about it?
What is sinister about it? Again, good stuff, Kay. You are opening the door for him. What is sinister about all of this? His answer. Well, it's very important you hear it.
You have children, you know, who are getting medications that are damage them, and that parents have to sign for in order to get access to them because they're so bad. But we won't prescribe medical cannabis. So to me, that makes no sense.
Makes no sense, right?
And I go and I think to myself, well, this has been going on now for so long. We look at all any reasonable person could look at this and understand and go, well, why is it not being prescribed?
So do you think potentially it's because it's so expensive that it's...
Mm.
that it's not available on the NHS?
No, because there's medications again. There's medications that are being prescribed that are 10 times more expensive.
Medications being prescribed for children with severe epilepsy right now that are 10 times more expensive. Keep that in mind.
That we prescribe for epilepsy.
So why do you think it is?
I honestly don't know. We've got bodies here who are writing guidelines against it. I think a big part of it is a stigma around cannabis. So you have that stigma around it. You have the element of the trusts. So they're the people who are actually blocking this. That's where the block comes from, not from MPs or anything like that. Matt Hancock should have got a hold of this situation, and he hasn't done.
I don't know whether Robin Emerson actually knows the answer and is sidetracking it in the interview with Burley because he wants to protect his daughter, or if he's just very close to the answer but not quite there yet. He said, I don't know if it's the stigma around cannabis. It isn't. And then he said, it's the NHS trusts maybe, and he's getting very close to the truth there. They're prescribing licensed medication developed by massive pharmaceutical companies. That medication is costing massive amounts of money, 10 times more than the cannabis oil. And as he said, that medication has terrible side effects for the children. Come on. I mean, come on. This is the World Health Organization and Big Pharma, which is the same thing. Revolving door. The WHO is stacked from top to bottom with men and women who have worked for some of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world. The World Health Organization is in control of the NHS. Trusts in total control. Jesus, it's obvious what's going on. That's the reason we haven't had any prescribing, or we haven't seen this cannabis oil, which can do so much good, why it hasn't been prescribed at all since November last when it was legalised. This is who's running the world, not these goon politicians like Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May. I'm tired of telling people. They're not in charge. All right. These faceless, massive corporations are running the show. The country legalises medicinal cannabis. Big Pharma says, well, fuck that. We'll show you. We'll show you. We'll just go to the NHS trusts. We'll go to the doctors because we control them. We'll make sure that nobody gets it. But they'll keep prescribing the let's call it what it is, the crap that we churn out of our factories. We'll keep doing that. And that's what happens. It's insane. And what does the cannabis oil do for young Georgia Emerson anyway?
Oh, it's amazing. Okay, like Georgia was having over 30 seizures a day. And now she's having less than 5. And her development has just shot through the roof. So you have people like her physio team who are saying to me that it's like a different child. They can't believe it. Georgia couldn't do all these things beforehand. She'd lost her smile, her laugh. That's all back. And I'm lucky that I have a private company who stepped in to fund Georgia's medication. But they could pull that from me tomorrow. And I'm back to square one.
Yeah. A naturally occurring plant with oil that has miraculous effects on not just people with severe epilepsy in children, but any number of other conditions, including cancer, as we know. And people can't... You see, this is the thing, you see. I think a number of you have already said on Twitter, Big Pharma won't get anything out of it. Yeah. That's certainly part of it. On that level, that's one level, that's certainly part of it. They cannot ever allow people to understand that the cure, and we mean cure, not the treatment, because what Big Pharma does is it relieves the symptoms of many conditions that are suffered by people all over the world. Relieves. Temporary relief. But many of their medicines also cause different problems. So you'll get a medicine made by Glaxo, and it might relieve the symptoms of hay fever, for example, but it will also make you fucking impotent. Okay? Surrounding us, on our mountains, in our hills, in our trees, in our rivers, are naturally occurring plant life that have the key to healing completely every ailment that any man or woman has ever experienced in the history of planet Earth. And the cannabis plant is the gateway to people understanding this. And that's why they'll do everything they can to keep people from getting their hands on it. This is Wednesday's Richie Allen Show, by the way. Hope you're well. Got a couple of brilliant guests for you this Wednesday. Kevin Barrett joins the program in the second hour, live from Madison, Wisconsin. Hee hee. And coming up in a few minutes' time, Tony Gosling, the presenter of The Politics Show on BCFM, joins me live. You can tweet the program at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Always good to hear from you. This is Michael Jackson, The Way You Make Me Feel. Michael Jackson, The Way You Make Me Feel on your Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on Fab Radio 2 here in Manchester, in Greater Manchester, is where I am today. Fab Radio at triggerwarning.tv, the TuneIn radio app as well. Good to be with you. My first guest today needs little introduction to you. Before we say hello to him, he's pulled over, by the way. He's pulled over. He's driving on the UK's national motorways today. And he's pulled over. Before that, Sky News is reporting this afternoon that the president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, has been briefing the media in his own country and has told them that Iran will boost its enrichment of uranium to, quote, whatever amount it feels like. He's repeated what he said at the weekend. Okay, Sky says this is a vital component for a nuclear bomb. The Iranians say they don't have any intention of making a nuclear bomb, but what they are doing is in response to fresh sanctions from the United States of America, announced last week by Donald Trump. This all goes back to Trump pulling the US out of the 2015 nuclear deal. Okay, Trump pulled the US out of it last year. And he also acted to bar all international sales of Iranian oil. I mentioned Tony already. He's the host of the Politics Show on BCFM in Bristol. He's much more besides as well. I won't drone on about his resume. Let's just welcome him back to the programme. Tony, thanks for coming on today. How are you doing?
All right, Richie. Thanks for calling again. Lovely always to have the pleasure of your company and your listeners.
You're a gent, mate. You're a top contributor. It's a great pleasure. It's our pleasure to have you on. How serious is this going to get? Gerald Celente, the trends forecaster who drops in on me from time to time, as you do, he's been forecasting for the last couple of years that this is building up into something that's going to be very, very serious. Are we at the beginning of something that is going to lead ultimately to a conflict, a military conflict between the US, Israel and other actors in the region and Iran? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I haven't heard any other commentator link the North Korea story to the Iran story, because we've seen, haven't we, over the last few days, the amazing rapprochement, apparently via Twitter, between Trump and Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
And, you know, Trump stepping into North Korea. I would suggest there's a sinister angle towards this, in that the US foreign policy people, and by the way, that's Jared Kushner and Mike Pompeo. There was a fascinating article the other day from Rex Tillerson, who used to be the boss of Exxon, who was Trump's first Secretary of State, who was then replaced because he apparently had been moaning to Trump, saying, well, Jared Kushner keeps interfering in my foreign policy, so he was sacked and Pompeo was brought in. But apparently, this is what Tillerson has said, is that Jared Kushner was running his own foreign policy and Tillerson wasn't allowed to do anything about it. And of course, Kushner is really the voice of Netanyahu in US politics. So I think what's going on here with North Korea is that the whole North Korea thing is being put on hold. Let's cool down in North Korea and let's focus on getting a war going with Iran. And I think they're actually serious about this. I really do.
You really do see that. Yeah. It's interesting you say that, because over the weekend, Fox News presenter Tucker Carlson, who's a very different type of presenter than the one you'd ordinarily expect to come across on Fox, he's very much anti-war, he's very much anti-US hegemony in the world and in the Middle East, and he interviewed Trump, and he pressed Trump as much as you'd expect a Fox News anchor to press him on it. And Trump was talking up the fact that he hadn't responded to the drone coming down. He also, has seemingly marginalised the lunatic hawk John Bolton in recent days. So some of our listeners might think, well, let's give Trump the benefit of the doubt for now. At least this week, he's been saying and doing the right things, Tony. Re-Iran.
How long can he keep it up? This is the trouble. He's circling. He's almost like a cowboy being circled by Indians. All the time, he's under more and more pressure. And, of course, there's this FBI prosecution as well, which is putting him under pressure. I mean, I just think eventually he's going to be bullied into doing what he's being told to do. It's the arms industry and it's the Zionist lobby that are pushing for this, because the arms industry stand to make an absolute fortune out of any kind of conflict. And it seems pretty obvious to me that the tension is being ramped up and up. Each time we see some sort of conflict in the Gulf, whether it's a drone or one of the tankers or a pumping station that's hit or an airport that's hit,
oh, we've lost
by the Houthis or whatever side it happens to be, it seems to be getting more tense each time or more dangerous each time. I mean, just look at the state of the tankers a few weeks ago. You know, you've got one of the tankers just had a hole in the side of it, but the other one was the whole of the side of the tanker had been burning. You know, so it seems to me that the idea is each time there is a provocation in the Gulf, whether it's the Persian Gulf or the Gulf of Oman or the Straits of Hormuz itself, which is in between the two, it is getting worse and it's getting more serious. So I don't think they're going to give up on this, Richie.
No, they won't. Here's a question for you. I've got to bring in the Labour Party. Some front bench members of the Labour Party, including the leader himself, have had very close ties to the Stop the War coalition over the years. You and I both know many people who have worked tirelessly for the Stop the War coalition. And yet, on the Iranian question, there's been a deafening silence from the Labour Party front bench. Is that because they've got other fish to fry, namely Brexit, namely anti-Semitism allegations? What do you think?
Well, really good question. There's lots of stuff that the Labour Party, as an opposition party, should be saying. And let me tell you this absolutely for certain. People like Chris Williamson and people like Ken Livingstone, were they still in the Labour Party? And neither of them are anymore because they've both been booted out or suspended. They would be saying all sorts of things on these issues, but it looks as if that's one of the reasons why they've been kicked out.
Well, that's very interesting. So you believe that the people, the architects of a war with Iran, they play a very long game, even clever enough to remove the vocal opposition to it well in advance, Tony. Is that what you think?
Well, look, I mean, we know for a fact, an absolute fact, that the Israeli embassy, through Shai Massot, who was their political attaché, had offered £1 million to infiltrate the Labour Party for the benefit of the Israeli foreign ministry. Now, that seems to me to be absolutely exactly what most embassies do. Most of the time around the world, political attachés in these embassies and military attachés have a similar sort of role. But the only thing is, this time it was recorded by Al Jazeera, by no means perfect channel, but it just shows how appalling our media is in Britain, that we have to leave it to the Qatari state broadcaster to dish the dirt on these people.
It's horrible as well. I did a broadcast last week where I specifically focused on the pretty dark career of Dame Margaret Hodge. Now, you know, there are those who would say it's pretty cheap to be dragging up the past in that way. But because Hodge is the Witchfinder General in terms of trying to out people as anti-Semitic, it's very important to point out as often as we can, because the mainstream media is ignoring it, that Margaret Hodge deliberately covered up paedophilia going on in Islington when she was leader of Islington Council. And not only that, but she had to pay one of the victims compensation after sending him a letter basically calling him a deranged individual. This is a horrible person. And this sort of stuff is relevant, Tony, when Hodge is calling everybody and sundry anti-Semitic, right?
Well, there's another aspect to Hodge as well, is that she, as a Labour Party person, supposedly, one does, you know, wonder whether she's just kind of infiltrating the Labour Party to disrupt it. She's also failing to pay tax. She's got loads of... there's a brilliant article just a couple of days ago. I can't remember which of the mainstream websites or national newspapers is, explaining how she does her tax avoidance. I mean, she has she has a massive amount of wealth and loads of companies, but she pays virtually no tax at all on those things. So these are the sorts of things you'd expect, you know, the Daily Mirror, etc., to be exposing, but nobody seems to be doing that, Richie.
Nobody's doing it, no. Of course, Margaret Hodge is an Oppenheimer. She's worth untold, unimaginable amounts of money. And the fact that she's avoiding paying taxes in this country, the fact that she was found to be covering up, and she was covering it up. It's not that she didn't know about it. She knew about it and chose to cover it up in Islington. This is a pretty vile individual. Tony Gosling has stopped on his travels to speak to us today. We're very grateful to Tony for that. Thisweek.org.uk, the politics show on BCFM is unmissable. There's nothing like it on radio in the UK today. There isn't. It's a terrific programme. Let me ask you this, friend.
I mean, listen, hang on, Richie, because you do a similar thing to what we do, which no, very, very, very few people do, and the broadcasters should be doing this, and that is to be doing world news coverage and national news coverage from the regions and from outside London. Almost everything is focused in London. I mean, for many years, the Guardian newspaper was based in Manchester, and they were doing world news coverage, they were doing national news coverage from Manchester. But then they moved to London. And for example, in Bristol, we have massive ethnic communities from all over the world. You know, enormous West Indian, Somali. I mean, you know, there's a list as long as your arm. So why not, as we do from time to time, when there's something to say, for example, about Sudan, why do you need to be in London? No, we talk to the Sudanese or the Somali Bristol community and get the word out from the regions. You know, so this is one of the things I think is part of the propaganda media model we're looking at in Britain. It's focusing everything in London. It's much easier to control like that. And that's why that mold needs to be broken.
It does indeed. There's a couple of big stories this week that are worth talking about. The culture, the Digital Media and Culture Committee finished their consultation on the online harms white paper, which they published a few weeks ago. The consultation finished the day before yesterday. The news media collectively has come out and said that it's a terrifying thing, this online harms white paper. And it's ultimately going to have a devastating effect for free speech on the internet, Tony. You're obviously worried about this and you're thinking about this as well.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, this is one way, isn't it, to censor the internet, to get rid of all the wonderful opportunities that there have been to share information. I mean, I think one of the reasons the internet has exploded as it has is as it came along, I compare it really to the golden age of television. So we're talking about the 1960s and 70s, particularly fantastic TV, all sorts of brilliant creative stuff, brave, courageous material, gripping, you know, engaging. And that was closed down, I think, really in the 1980s and the 1990s. We're seeing a similar sort of thing happening with the internet now, I think. So we've had the noughties and most of this last decade at the golden age of the internet. Everyone has been driven quite obviously onto platforms of social media and to the tech giant platforms like Google in order to get any kind of decent coverage, because the mainstream media has become so bland, so propagandistic. And now those tech giants are starting to be closed down too. So in other words, if you want to post the truth on Facebook, you will often find a little notice comes up and says, sorry, this post has breached the community guidelines, this sort of thing. So you simply cannot use these. In many cases, you cannot use these tech giants to share the truth anymore, Richie. So that's the way I look at this, just another way of closing the internet down, saying that, oh, this is causing harm, etc. Of course, in the meantime, there's fantastic amounts of pornography allowed and available on the internet. And we know now that much of the pornography is viewed by, you know, boys of around 11, 12, 13 years old. That doesn't really seem to bother them so much. That's one of the things that this online harms legislation is supposed to do something about. But is it going to? Who knows? I think the main reason for it, I agree with you, the main reason for it is to start shutting down good alternative sources for news. Because the mainstream is just appalling with news nowadays. It's so, I mean, there's all these demonized states like the Iranians, like the Russians. A lot of people really take seriously this idea that Russia is now a fascist country and Putin is like Hitler. You know, yeah, I mean, even had Prince Charles calling Putin Hitler. You know, this is the sort of madness, I think, which is designed to herd people towards the situation where a war suddenly becomes a reasonable proposition.
You're right, Tony. The anti-Russian stuff is relentless. There are stories emerging today again about doping in Russian athletics. It's just relentless. It never stops. On a final word on the online harms thing, we can maybe then talk just a little bit about Hong Kong. Love to get your thoughts on that. But before...
I also want to get in some stuff about these European appointments.
Oh, yeah, well, of course. Huge story, of course. We were going to get into that anyway. But the regulator... Once this online harms stuff becomes law, the regulator, which will either be the existing regulator or a new regulator, would effectively have the power, I mean, the most powerful regulator in the world, to decide what constitutes harm and what doesn't, and can have stuff struck down or struck off the internet, even if it isn't against the law of the land. It's terrifying stuff, this. And it's coming in. It's not even... speculation, this is coming in. Before we talk about the madness of the anti-democratic European Union, I look at the Hong Kong situation, the protests that have been going on for weeks. Apparently they began about extradition, but they're more about democracy and more besides, I think. Could it be that what we are seeing in Hong Kong is, on the face of it, pretty much what we are seeing? I know that's a very badly phrased question, but there are a number of people saying there's a conspiratorial element to the students protesting. There are actors outside of China, outside of Hong Kong, trying to influence things there. Couldn't it just be that the truth is that in Hong Kong they've had enough of the encroachment of the Chinese government? They've had enough of the Chinese government kind of reneging on the one country, two systems plan. Could it just be as we see it, Tony?
Okay, so these protests have been incredibly massive. In other words, between millions of people turning out on the street and incredibly well organized. I mean, I don't think that's just the CIA or MI6 helping with the organization necessarily. I think Hong Kong people, for decades now, have been seriously worried about whether they're going to get the same kind of laws imposed in China. One thing I would say as a caveat, though, is the Chinese, I believe, are doing this for a specific reason. And that specific reason is the arrest of the Huawei finance officer in Canada and the extradition threat of her to the United States. So I think that's one of the reasons why the Chinese are now imposing this.
Very interesting.
And nobody seems to really have recognized that. So since we've got a Chinese citizen about to be extradited to the US from Canada, the Chinese seem to be saying, well, if you could do that, so can we. And that's, I think, the main cause of what's happening now with this new legislation in Hong Kong. So what the Chinese are doing is not just all on its own. It's a reaction to something specific that the West is doing, which is, particularly pernicious. So anyway, having been to Hong Kong myself about 18 months ago and spent a couple of weeks there, and one of the most fascinating places, Richie, is something called the Foreign Correspondents Club, where you get cheap drink and cheap meals and also fascinating conversation with foreign correspondents who've been working in the region, the whole of Asia, really, including Australasia, etc., for 30, 40 years, is that they don't believe that China is strong enough to totally change Hong Kong.
Very
they actually believe that the other way round is more necessary, that China will become more like Hong Kong. And I said to these correspondents, surely this is just Western propaganda. They say the trouble is that actually Hong Kong works really, really well. And the people who live in China around Hong Kong know this. And there's no way that the Chinese government are going to be able to impose a China-like authoritarian system where there isn't any real freedom of speech on Hong Kong. So this is a tension that is coming along. And I honestly do not know whether the David or the Goliath in this situation is going to win the day.
Very interesting, Tony. Let's talk about the European Union. The Parliament reconvened the day before yesterday, Monday, of course. The Brexit Party wouldn't acknowledge Ode to Joy, the European National Anthem, all sorts of funny things going on. But most importantly, it's going to get its first female commission president, it looks like it now. That's very interesting. A woman called Ursula von der Leyen, and the Italian socialist will be the new head of the European Parliament, a guy called David Maria Sassoli. What's very interesting about the last couple of days of kind of manoeuvring in Brussels and in Strasbourg is that it should be even more clear to anybody than maybe it was before just how completely anti-democratic the whole European project is. What have you made of Ursula von der Leyen, the whole election process for the Commission President and all the rest of it? What are your thoughts?
Okay, well, first of all, just on the pronunciation, it's Ursula von der Leyen.
Von der Leyen, which I suppose is ironic.
Von der Leyeness, maybe we should call her.
Yeah.
But look, okay, so the reason I know how to pronounce her name is because I was taught it over in Germany by the Bilderberg attendees in 2016.
She was at Bilderberg.
The Bilderberg meeting in Dresden. One of the things that came out of that meeting was that it was the second year, and these were rumours that came from the hotel, it was the second year in a row where von der Leyen had been sitting next to Henry Kissinger at the top table on the Saturday evening's Bilderberg evening meal. And we've been scratching our heads ever since, Richie.
Who is she?
Thinking, well, what is she?
Yeah.
Is she going to make, well, she was the defence minister at the time, is she going to make it to become the replacement for Merkel? Surely. You know, if Kissinger and the Bilderbergers are tapping her up to be a European leader, as they always do. And I was absolutely gobsmacked to hear yesterday, wow, von der Leyen could be taking over as the Commission President. Now, one of the things that she's been doing, and she's been spearheading as German Defence Minister, is the integration of all the EU armed forces. So she's been spearheading that programme. And I think she's been put in charge is because that is her main task. She will, over the next few years, be bringing all the militaries of the EU countries under one command. And that's her job. And, of course, that command would be essentially NATO command, because NATO are based in Brussels too. So that's my reading of her being put in charge of the nearly billion population.
She's going to oversee military she's going to oversee military unification, Tony.
I honestly think that's why. And I was really amazed that she wasn't taking on a bigger role in German politics, you know, or in some other European role of one sort or another. But to now hear that she's going to be the top dog, appointed, never elected by anybody, appointed by the Bilderbergers, by Kissinger, by, you know, the global financial elite in the Western world to run the United States of Europe, that actually now the penny's dropped. It doesn't come as such a great surprise at all.
It's very interesting. Yesterday afternoon, you may not have seen it, but Sky News had a number of MEPs speaking live from Strasbourg, and a number of them kept referring to the national anthem, which is a bit of a Freudian slip, and they were corrected several times. Like the Brexit Party guys were there, and they were saying, listen, it's not a national anthem, it's a European anthem. But it's amazing, the thinking of the political class in the UK is that this is a nation-state project. This is going to be, as you described it, the United States of Europe, and that's that. It's quite remarkable, really. And Jeremy Corbyn, by the way, and I love you, mate. We've been speaking for years, me and you. But I love to bash Jeremy every now and then when you're on the programme. Corbyn, of course. I know you're not a supporter of any politician. Corbyn today, more or less, well, not more or less, actually did, at Prime Minister's questions, throw the gauntlet down and asked for a second referendum. The faux socialist, the Social Democrat Jeremy Corbyn. So Labour, he's capitulated now to the Blairites in his own party and the Europhiles, and he's now towing the line and asking for a second referendum. We're never going to leave, Tony. Never.
Well, it might... Well, hang on, because the Conservatives are in charge at the moment, just about. So yeah. They may bring us out. They may just about still, even though there's a lot of people saying that they can't still. I take you back to... I think we've had this conversation before. It's a fascinating article by Karl von Habsburg, the leader of the Pan-European Union, which was begun in 1923, I think it was, before even the Nazi Party was formed in Munich, in the same city. And he is saying that the Brexit is a reality TV show. These are literally the Holy Roman Emperors of the past, who are now an aristocracy, a massive landowning and capital-controlling aristocracy, who are sitting behind the scenes. You'll never see them on television talking about anything at all, but nevertheless, they are the owners of Europe. They're the owners of the place. They're not politicians, per se, but they are deciding what's actually going on. But then we've got to also mention Christine Lagarde taking over as the head of the European Central Bank, because isn't that fascinating, too? She is a convicted criminal.
Convicted criminal.
Convicted financial criminal. Back in 2008, she stole £350 million and gave it in France to one of Sarkozy's financial backers. And she was taken to court in France 2 years ago and prosecuted and convicted. But then, guess what?
No punishment.
Overturned. Unbelievable, really. And she was told that even though she was facing a year in prison for that, no, it's okay. You don't have to go to prison, Christine Lagarde, because we've got another job for you. It's head of the European Central Bank. So you've now got a convicted financial criminal who should have done at least a year in prison running the whole of the Eurozone, which is governing the finances of something like 800 million people across the EU Eurozone.
You're absolutely right. And for listeners who are new to that information, they shouldn't be, because Tony Gosling back in 2016 was talking about this. I was talking about this. Just Google Lagarde, guilty of government payout and massive government payout, and you'll see that. A convicted criminal running the European Central Bank. These are.
I should say also, Christine Lagarde has been a attender at the Bilderberg meeting.
For years.
You know, yeah. I'm not saying, by the way, that Bilderberg is the top of global capitalism in the West, generally. I mean, there occasionally are Chinese involved in this, the big Chinese banks as well, for example. But they are certainly the main political lobby of Europe, of global financial capitalism. So they are, the Bilderberg conference is where you'll see all the leaders come along before they actually become the leaders of Europe, before they become prime ministers, presidents, that sort of thing. They're always tapped up at Bilderberg. It's like a kind of horse trading session where the people that own most of the West money in the Western world get a chance to say, oh, this is the next big politician. So, you know, some of the small fry, they may not go to Bilderberg because they don't have much power over our futures. But those, I mean, just think also, by the way, about what's happened with Catalonia.
Yes.
I mean, the Catalan leader has been elected as an EU MEP, but he's been refused the opportunity to actually take up his seat. So, you know, the EU is only interested in centralising power in its own hands.
Of course it is.
No real democracy involved there whatsoever.
No, I can't argue with any of that. I can't, even though maybe I should sometimes.
I mean, about 5G, by the way.
Yeah, just before you do, you know, go ahead. Yeah, because I did speak about this at the top of the programme. It's been switched on in seven cities today, including Manchester. No health impact study. Potentially devastating. Go ahead, Tony.
Apparently it's coming on in Bristol today. Vodafone are running 5G in Bristol. I'm not sure if they've switched it on. No idea. But I had a chat, an interesting chat, with the Green Group leader, Ursula Cumley, in Bristol. And it's a big Green contingent on the City Council. It looks like we may well get the second Green MP in the next general election in Bristol, because the Labour Party have been so hopeless under the Mayor Marvin Rees there. And she's a physicist. So I spoke to her on the phone. I said, can you come on the radio? Sorry, it's Eleanor. to talk about 5G, to explain this, the health effects, you know, and also how green it is or how not green it is, because of course it's taking massive amounts more energy to use this system. And she's a physicist. I thought she'd be keen to do that. But no.
No.
The Greens are very worried about talking about 5G for one reason, and that is that the EU is in charge of regulating all this, and the EU has completely failed to regulate it by putting all of the telecoms companies in charge of the regulation.
That's right.
So it's a very interesting thing for the Greens to talk about, or any pro-EU people to talk about, that it's actually a complete failure of regulation by Brussels.
I've had somebody on the programme that you know very well. I've had him on a couple of times in the last few weeks talking about this, Chris Busby. I've had Chris on, I've had Barry Trower on, of course, but Chris Busby, this is going to be a global killer, this. And look,
I learned recently about 5G, and you may have covered this yourself, but it's a low frequency and high frequency too. So the high frequencies of 5G are actually higher frequency than radar. Now, we all know how damaging the radar frequencies have been. They covered up in World War II, but these are the high, you know, power microwaves and high frequency microwaves that 5G is letting out. But the trouble is those high frequency waves find it difficult to get into people's homes. So they have a low frequency contingent which gets through the walls and into your house. This is really a pernicious technology which is designed to penetrate our lives at every level possible, Richie.
Tony, it's disgusting. We'll talk about 5G again in the near future, you and me. Before we go today, thanks for stepping off the motorway today to chat with us, by the way. It means a lot to me, mate. No matter what I ever put to you about whatever subject, you're always well briefed. You've always got a good answer. It's an amazing thing, really. Not too many around like you. But by the time we speak again, there will be a new Prime Minister. Who will it be? Will it be Johnson? Will it be Hunt? Does it even matter, Tony?
Well, yes, it does matter, because Hunt is just another Remainer. But the idea is really, I mean, look at William Hill, yeah? Look at the bookies' money is all on Boris, and they're quite good at getting it right. So I imagine it will be Boris, but then that's because Boris is easily manipulated. We've got an interview with Ken Livingstone, we're using an exclusive on Friday, where I can just leak to you. Ken says basically, because I thought he's the best person to talk to about Boris, having been beaten by him in London, and he says, well, Boris isn't actually a politician. He's just a wannabe celebrity. He's only interested in the limelight, you know, the cameras, the lights, being in the studio, being in the centre of attention. And, of course, that means that although he may become Prime Minister, he's going to be an absolutely hopeless Prime Minister because all he's interested in is his own narcissistic self-attention. And, you know, he will not be able to deal with any of these issues like we were talking about Iran and the nuclear option, you know, the idea that is Iran enriching uranium. He hasn't got his head around any of this at all. In fact, I mean, none of the Western press has really explained that the Iranians have been enriching uranium to 3 2/3%, which is really very, very minimal. You need 90% enriched uranium to actually make a nuclear weapon. And none of the media in the West has explained that. They're saying, oh, the Iranians are enriching uranium. This is exactly the sort of nonsense that Boris will not be able to get to grips with. And so that's what makes him a hopeless leader, even though he may be more pro-Brexit than Jeremy Hunt.
We're going to wait and see. Tony, thanks for doing it today. Thisweek.org.uk, The Politics Show with Tony Gosling on BCFM. Check it out. Follow Tony on Twitter as well. There's only one Tony Gosling. Thanks, mate. Let's do it again in a few weeks. Thanks for your help, Tony.
God bless, Richie. Thanks very much for asking me on.
You too. Will you stop? It's an absolute honour, mate. Thanks. The brilliant Tony Gosling there, live on the line from one of the UK's motorways. He's driving today, Tony, and stepped off the motorway to have a chat with us. Great guy. Thisweek.org.uk. Loads of tweets on that. On Margaret Hodge, mentioned earlier on. Margaret Hodge. On Christine Lagarde. Thanks to Moinga for the tweets. I've retweeted those articles there. David Stanford says Prescott Bush was convicted of funding the enemy and direct lineage garnered two commanders in crime. That's right. That's right. His son and his grandson became president of the United States of America. Hi to Robin, who was asking about chemtrails. I posted some pictures on the YouTube live stream earlier on. Pictures that I had taken this morning in Salford of a completely blue and pristine summer morning sky, as the sky should be. And I said that in the next day or two, I will take a picture at exactly the same time, at around about 25 minutes past six, maybe half six in the morning, and the sky will be covered from horizon to horizon with the tic-tac-toe noughts and tic-tac-toe noughts and crosses formations of the spraying. Because it happens here as much as I've seen it happen anywhere, and I've seen it everywhere. All right. Guy Master Flex says, Richie, today is the 31st anniversary of when the US shot down an Iranian passenger plane. Cheers for that, mate. You're absolutely spot on. We're coming up to a minute past six. It's time for another tune. When we come back from that, I'll be joined live from Madison, Wisconsin by the one and only Kevin Barrett. It's Wednesday's Richie Allen Show from a sweltering Salford. And this is Texas. Charlene Spiteri, Texas, Inner Smile on the Richie Allen Show, live from Salford, Greater Manchester. Drive time, 4 minutes past six UK time it is. Live on Fab Radio 2, triggerwarning.tv, TuneIn Radio. And the programme is archived on iTunes, Spotify, Podomatic, and even the Truth Seeker app. It's been quite a while since we've heard from my next guest. He's one of my favourite contributors. And you know, I don't say that very often about anybody, because he was one of the, I suppose, the first relationships I made when I began my own journey, when I left commercial and mainstream media and began to look into things that I'd never considered worthy of looking into in the past. And he was one of the first people I encountered because of his appearances on Fox News, educating people about the many anomalies in the official story of September the 11th. He's an amazing man. He's an academic. He's a teacher. He's a theologian. He's a broadcaster and an author. And you can read him at truthjihad.com. That's truthjihad.com. And he's also headed up and founded an organization, the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for Truth, the MUGCA, the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for Truth. He's been traveling in Malaysia of late. Delighted to welcome back my old pal, Dr. Kevin Barrett. Kevin, welcome back. How you doing?
Well, I'm well, Richie. It's even better to be back on the Richie Allen Show than to be back in the US of A.
You're a gent. It sounds like you're a little bit... what we get when we come back from any great trip abroad, any holiday, we do have that down time, that little bit of depression, post-holiday blues, when we get back. You've been in Malaysia. By all accounts, it was an amazing trip. Why were you there, Kev? What was going on? What was happening in Malaysia?
Well, Malaysia is a really interesting place right now in many respects. Well, it's an interesting place anytime, I suppose. But right now we have Prime Minister Dr. Mahathir Mohamad back in power. And he is one of our 9/11 truth heroes, our anti-bankster heroes. He kept the banksters from ruining Malaysia in the 1990s when they were crashing the Asian Tigers. He stood face to face with Soros, and Soros blinked. And the Malaysian economy kept going fine, while all the other economies in the region had been destroyed by Soros and his friends. And then after 9/11, Dr. Mahathir presided over various tribunals on 9/11. Well, actually, it was more of a conference on 9/11, but he also presided over the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunals, which I think was finished in 2013. And he convicted the president of the United States, a former president, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and others of various crimes, war crimes. And he convicted the state of Israel of genocide. Yeah. So this guy is no slouch.
He's incredibly interesting. And he never gets so much as a whisper of a mention in Western media these days. Even when he was returned to power last year, it barely merited a mention, Kevin. No surprise, because of obviously his past. When he convicted these people in absentia, it's always good to hear that, but it's also terribly depressing, isn't it, Kevin? Because they'll never face... I know you think they'll face justice in the next life, and I hope you're right, but in this life, their victims will never get to see them in court, will they?
Probably not. I don't think Malaysia is going to succeed in extraditing those guys anytime soon.
No,
unfortunately.
And yet we have Julian Assange, whose birthday is today, and it's likely that Assange is going to be extradited to the United States because he was given material that was in, was absolutely in the public interest to know, and he published it, and the US wants to get him over there. You don't hold out any hope whatsoever that the UK government will do the right thing, Kevin, and say, no, you're not having him. It looks like they will extradite him there.
Well, the UK government, like the rest of the European governments, is occupied by NATO. NATO is just a euphemism for the US occupation of Europe. The poodle in the UK ever decides to bite the hand that feeds and disciplines it, I will be very surprised. But, you know, nothing's impossible. The courageous Tony Blair, and of course I'm being sarcastic, did stand up to Bush when Bush was saying that the U.S. and the U.K. together ought to bomb Al Jazeera's headquarters in Qatar. So that was one case where the U.K. stood up to the U.S. a little tiny bit. I'm not sure there were very many others, though.
No, there aren't very many others. Loads of tweets when you come on the program. Always loads of tweets. John Byrne tweets, Richie, Could Kevin's what Kevin was talking there about the Malaysian PM Mahathir bin Mohamed, could what he did in terms of standing up to the bullies and the tyrants behind September the 11th, could that have anything to do with the downing of two Malaysian airliners, Kevin?
Well, that's true. It was quite a coincidence, wasn't it, that after these war crimes tribunals, suddenly Malaysian airliners started dropping out of the skies. And in fact, I'm working on an article right now about Malaysian Flight 370, which disappeared under very strange circumstances. And there's a brand new article in The Atlantic that purports to have solved the mystery, but it's very dubious. The author, William Langewich, also authored an article blaming the Egyptian airliner, what was that, 990, I think, on a pilot, a suicide pilot. And that case was clearly not done by the suicide pilot. The only evidence they had that Egyptian 990 co-pilot took the plane down on purpose was they had him crying out for God's help as the plane was going down. And that's precisely what you would do if
of course
you were fighting
would.
To regain control. It's not at all what you would do if you were committing suicide. So that was a huge lie. And the guy who supported that lie in an Atlantic article that came out just a couple of months after 9/11 is now back supporting the claim that once again we have a Muslim suicide pilot taking down this Malaysian airliner, Flight 370. Interesting, isn't it, Richie, how we get these alleged Muslim suicide pilots all over the place? 9/11 was supposedly done by four Muslim suicide pilots. We all know now that's not true. And I suspect that all six of these cases were actually done by the same people in an intelligence agency. And I think there's circumstance that around Flight 370, but there's very strong evidence to support it regarding 9/11.
You think they took control of the planes remotely, Kevin? Because I know nothing about any of this stuff. That's why I first invited you on my program back in 2009 in Spain. Do you think these things were taken control of from the ground? I've spoken to the very eccentric but very wonderful, very nice Field McConnell many times. Field is very eccentric, but I think he's a really decent guy and I think he's sincere. These things can be taken control of from a mobile phone, Kevin.
Yes, I think that's the most likely explanation for what happened on 9/11. There are folks who have various plane swap hypotheses and missile into the Pentagon hypotheses and things like that. The simplest and most straightforward way to do it, as far as I'm concerned, would be to remote fly the planes into their targets. That's what Bob Bowman thought happened. Bob Bowman was the former head of SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, that is the Star Wars program under two U.S. presidents. And Bob was a fighter pilot in Vietnam with 101 combat missions under his belt. He was a Caltech rocket science PhD, definitely a very smart guy with experience in all of these areas. And he told me that he was reasonably certain that it was done by remote hijacking and that all of this plane swap stuff is probably just muddying the waters. So I would lean towards that hypothesis. And I think that's also a likely hypothesis about what happened to these other two airliners. In the case of Egypt 990, they wanted to take that plane down because it was full of all of the top anti-Israel generals in the Egyptian military. And then with Flight 370, it may have had something to do with a bunch of Chinese nationals and some U.S. semiconductor people who were on board. It may also have had to do with a couple of Iranians who were purportedly on board flying to Ukraine to get political asylum. But I think in both cases, well, obviously, Israel would be the likely suspect for taking down Flight 990 and those anti-Israel generals. And with Malaysia convicting Israel of genocide and trying to expose 9/11, once again, the neocons and the government that supports them the most, namely Israel, would be the prime suspects.
Would be the prime suspects. Yeah, in fairness, I'd have to go along with that. Ordinarily, I'd argue with you. But no, I'll go along with that. It must be said, Kevin doesn't like this very much because he's a very modest man, but Kevin Barrett is a hero. Because when September the 11th happened, in the very, very early years after that, Kevin was, along with Jim and only really one or two others, had the courage to put their heads above the parapet and say, listen, something is very wrong here. You know, these were very difficult times for them personally, as they had this patriotic fervour whipped up by the right-wing press and the right-wing broadcast networks in America, basically cheerleading a war to Iraq, you know, disgracefully. And what you were doing at the time, Kevin, I'll never forget that, you know, because many of us wouldn't know anything about it if it wasn't for you. And that's important that we always acknowledge that. I know, what are we now? We're approaching 20 years. It's incredible to me that we're coming up on 20 years since it happened, but it's still so important. We should never stop talking about it because we are seeing the effects even still today. When I say the effects, the plans that were forged before 9/11 are being implemented today, aren't they, Kevin, around the world, and Iran right now, of course.
Well, Iran was number 7 on the hit list.
Yeah.
General Clark told us that he was approached by neocons shortly after 9/11, and he learned that the plan was to take out 7 countries in 5 years. And the last and most important country on that list was Iran. So they're way behind schedule, thanks to the determined resistance of the people of Iraq and Afghanistan, among other places, and thanks to the determined resistance from within the U.S. deep state. There are people in fairly high levels in the U.S. military and intelligence community, and I've met a few, who are not at all happy about what was done to the United States on 9/11. In other words, we were tricked into going to war primarily on behalf of Israel. And a lot of folks don't like that. So there's been pushback within the U.S. There's been massive pushback by the people of Iraq and Afghanistan. And now we're going to see whether these crazies can actually get their wish. And basically, they want to perpetrate mass murder in Iran, and they want to specifically target Iranian scientists. Most people don't realize, Richie, that the Israeli strategic objective in trashing Iraq was to make sure Iraq wouldn't be a strategic threat for the next couple of generations. To do that, they not only destroyed the country's economy and infrastructure and made sure it would be occupied by the U.S., but they also sent in hit squads, and 200 of the leading Iraqi scientists were murdered during the U.S. occupation, presumably by Mossad hit squads. And likewise with Iran, what they want to do is they want an excuse to just bomb all of the scientific installations as much as possible, kill as many Iranian scientists as possible. They're open about saying that the problem is not actual nuclear programs and hardware. The problem is the brains of the Iranian scientists. And so they want to splatter those brains and other blood all over the walls is basically what they're up to here. And whether the U.S. is foolish enough to go along with this remains to be seen. If it does, we're looking at a possible World War III at worst and something really, really, really nasty at best.
And is that because I know you've traveled in Iran because the Iranian military is very well trained and prepared for this eventuality. It's not quite like it was in Iraq, and it's certainly not like it was in Libya. This is a very disciplined, well-equipped military, and you don't have these various factions, you know, tribal and otherwise, that you had in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a different kettle of fish, Kevin, trying to attack Iran or even contemplating entering Iranian sovereign territory. They're better prepared, right?
Yeah, I think even the crazies who want to invade or attack Iran are probably not deluding themselves by imagining that they could do a ground invasion. I think what they want to do is just bomb just bomb Iran and target all those scientists and kill them so that the Iranian military capacity over the next few generations will be degraded. I think that's really what it's about. If they tried to invade Iran, they would be sucked into a mother of all quagmires. If they never just ending. Bomb Iran, they're still going to have a quagmire. Iran can shut down the Gulf, drive oil prices through the roof, target U.S. installations in the region, rain down hellfire on Israel, and create a lot of mayhem.
Would that happen, Kevin? To do that. Sorry to interrupt you. If they began a bombing campaign, and I think, and again, my expertise is no match for yours, but I think you're right, they wouldn't contemplate or consider the lunacy of a ground invasion. I think you've gotten it spot on. I think they would target the installations. I think you've really nailed it with the scientist thing. It's not something I've thought about a lot, but I think it makes a lot of sense what you're saying there. So obviously the next question, and you are answering it, you might say, why did you interrupt me, Richie? But I want to stop you on that point, because you believe that there would be a military response, not just causing havoc in the Strait of Hormuz, but they might actually counter-launch against Israel. Is that a possibility? So if the US starts dropping bombs on Iran, you think Iran would say, right, let's give it to Israel?
Well, that's precisely what he's the head of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Iranian parliament, just said the other day. He said Israel will cease to exist within 30 minutes of any U.S. attack on Iran. That may be an exaggeration, but I am sure the Iranians know who is pushing the U.S. into this war. This is not a U.S. war. This is an Israeli war. So who are you going to target? This, you know, the U.S. with its massive forces halfway around the world, or the real culprit who's right next door? And the thing about Iran, Richie, is that not only are they patriotic nationalists with a national history going back 3,000 plus years, but they're also Shia Muslims for the most part, who believe that if they're given the opportunity to die fighting in a just cause, that's the best possible way to die. So they're not people that you can easily convince to stop fighting. That's what Saddam Hussein learned to his chagrin when he invaded Iran in the 1980s.
You're talking
the Iranians fought back like tigers.
That's right, and you're talking to an Irishman, and I don't say that in jest. Various factions tried to conquer my country over centuries, including the imperialist Great Britain, and couldn't because, I suppose, again, because of the belief of the people in their culture, in who they were, and in their justification for defending themselves. You're absolutely right. I see that in the Iranian people whom I read, when I read them, when I read their articles online, their blogs, their newspapers. It would be an absolutely devastating. It would be devastating for the region. But I often wonder, and you and I have gotten into this before, and I've gotten into it with other more esoteric researchers than maybe your good self. You're an academic. You're a man of I've always seen you as a man, you know, who deals with what you can prove, what you can tangibly show to be real. But you and I both know there are esoteric researchers, many of them intelligent men and women, who think that there is some sort of unseen thing going on here, where there is some sort of entity or some sort of power, Kevin, that wants to turn the world into an absolute wasteland. You know, and Israel, as we know, has, what do we think it has, Kevin? 19, is it, or 29 nuclear warheads or something like that? I mean,
more like 400.
Is it 400, is it? Do you think 400, yeah. Wow, so if the Iranians started launching on Israel, well, presumably they would launch against Iran, and there's a basket case in Tel Aviv at the moment, and he's been there for years. What's to say that he wouldn't order the launch codes dialed up for a nuclear attack on Iran, Kevin? And is there some unseen power that wants to drive us to this destruction, humanity?
Well, yeah, that's very possible, Richie. You know, I was studying with Sheikh Imran Hossein over in Malaysia, and you know, you want to talk about brilliant people who take esoteric religious or other esoteric interpretations of what's going on now. Sheikh Imran Hossein, I think, is the best of that lot, and he argues that we are living in the end times, or Akhir Zaman, and he believes that scriptural sources suggest that we are facing the Antichrist, or Dajjal, who is going to be launching World War III, and we can expect the majority of the population to die. So yeah, there, according to Imran Hossein, there is a plan afoot to kill off most of the population in a nuclear World War III, and this could be the occasion. Now, Imran Hossein thinks it's likely to happen sooner rather than later, And I know there are many others who agree. So, yeah, I think there are dark forces at work. And I've actually come to agree with Sheikh Imran Hossein on this. I've studied the history of the heretical sort of satanic post-Jewish millenarianism. That is when a certain group of Jews 500 years ago decided they weren't going to wait for the Messiah to save them and take them back to the Holy Land. They were going to do it themselves, no matter what it took. And then with Shabtai Zvi, this became a sort of unholy crusade that involved committing atrocities and abominations and systematically violating the Ten Commandments. In other words, behaving satanically in order to force the Messiah to come back and conquer the world and establish his throne in Jerusalem and lift the Jews above all the Goyim. So this has been the covert ideology that led to Zionism for the past 500 years. So yeah, I think there is an esoteric dimension to all of this.
It's interesting because I interviewed a gentleman called Eric Gajewski a couple of weeks back, and Eric is a Catholic. He's a traditional Catholic. I found him very interesting, and I enjoyed his company, even though I don't share his beliefs. And I found him strangely, when I say strangely, refreshingly kind of not dogmatic and open to being disagreed with and challenged, and I liked him. I liked him because of that. The same reason I've always liked you, as bright as you are. You're always prepared to entertain somebody who's got a different opinion to yours. It's great. It's dying out, that. It's a great human quality that we're losing, sadly, as we kind of evolve. But I'm seeing it in many devout, when I say devout, many people who are committed, I shouldn't even say committed, people who deeply believe in a higher power, whether it is God or Allah or Jehovah, whatever. They all, many of them, particularly many of the brighter ones, seem to think that we are heading for some sort of apocalyptic end times, Kevin. And I saw a lot of that coming towards the end of the millennium. I think you and I spoke about this some years ago. We saw a lot of this in 97, 98, 99, understandably. And you could write it off back then. You could write it off saying, well, we're coming to the end of 1,000 years. It's understandable people think, well, this is weird. We're at 2,000. Maybe this is it. Maybe time is up. But we are seeing it a lot now, and I'm very open-minded. I'm not completely closed-minded to the idea that we might be in some sort of end times, and that these crazy characters that we see operating on the world stage are merely puppets, and something else is working through them. And the gentleman you mentioned from Malaysia, I'd be very interested in finding out more about him, you know, because, as I said, it's not unique to any one religious belief that something very, very big is coming this way very soon, you know. But then, don't all the religious students and scholars, don't they ultimately believe that something good will come after it, Kevin? Whatever happens, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. In fact, you know, the Christian and Islamic eschatology is almost identical. In both cases, Jews and Christians agree that Jesus was the Messiah and that he will return in the end times and defeat the Antichrist and institute a reign of justice. In the Islamic version, there will also be a sort of a friend of Jesus called the Mahdi, who will help. Other than that, it's practically identical. Whereas in the Jewish version, the Messiah was not Jesus. The Jews have very terrible things to say about Jesus, and they say that their Messiah still is coming in the future, and he may be alive today for all they know, and he will conquer the world for the Jews and subjugate the Goyim. He'll be a military conqueror who will rule the world from his throne in Jerusalem, presumably from the blood sacrifice temple that will be rebuilt after they destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So there's a huge difference between the Jewish eschatology and the Christo-Islamic eschatology, which is the same. Christians and Muslims have essentially the same eschatology. And this is very interesting. We're in the end times, apparently, so many people think we are, and yet so many Christians are buying in to the Zionist war on Islam and identifying the Muslims with the Antichrist. These Christians don't even realize that their eschatology and the Muslim eschatology is the same, whereas the Jewish eschatology is the eschatology of what one would expect to be the Antichrist, because they reject Jesus. They say he wasn't the Messiah, and so their Messiah will be an anti-Jesus Messiah, in other words, the Antichrist. So when Kushner and Chabad Lubavitch are scheming to put somebody in the throne in Jerusalem and to finish the Palestinian genocide and impose peace on earth, those people would be suspected of being on the side of the Antichrist, at least by most Christians and Muslims who knew their stuff.
Why do you think so many people who used to see through the lies about Muslims wanting to kill everybody and take over the world, who saw through the lies about Russia and about the Red Menace in the East, who saw through the lies about communists in the Cold War. Why have so many of them now swallowed this neocon Zionist agenda or characterization of Muslims taking over? Why, Kevin? Is it money? Is it for financial reasons or financial gain? Because many of the biggest alternative right personalities now used to be some of the biggest opponents of the creation of convenient enemies for us all to hate so that the elites could further their own agenda. Why are they falling for it?
Well, that's a great question, Richie. Some of my favorite 9/11 truth people, like Alex Jones and his friend Paul Joseph Watson, I used to love those guys. And suddenly they turned into raving Islamophobes about maybe 8 years ago. And I can't figure it out.
Money?
You know, maybe the kosher Nostra or the Mossad got some goods on those guys, got pictures of them doing something they shouldn't be doing. I don't know. It's hard to imagine. But I think the 9/11 operation did succeed in planting deep-seated Islamophobia into the collective unconscious of a great many people. And it kind of festered in there, deep in their unconscious for a while. And then it kind of, I think, emerged and took over. That's one way of looking at it. And then there's also the fact that there are reasons that people who identify as something other than or opposed to Islam and Muslims would look at Islam and say, wow, this religion is still working. It's very scary. We've lost our religion in the West, yet these Muslims still believe. They pray five times a day. They fast during Ramadan, and they're still marrying and having children, and they have family values. And demographically, they're reproducing a little bit faster than non-Muslims, which certainly poses a threat to Jewish supremacy in Israel, and might even pose a certain threat to European supremacy globally, although Russia, India, and so on probably pose more of a threat. But, you know, that Islamic demographic thing, driven by the fact that the religion is still intact and that the Muslim family and family values are still reasonably intact, far more so than any other culture, I think that has something to do with it, too. I think there's a certain envy here. People who are sort of right-wingers who, you know, they know they've lost their Christian family values, and then they look at the Muslims who still have those same kind of values. Like, you know, Richie, I grew up in, you know, the early 60s. I remember none of my parents' friends got divorced. People didn't use foul language. There was no sex or explicit violence in any media. Nobody would ever see any of that. It was a whole different world. And that world is still alive in Muslim countries.
To some extent
in Malaysia.
In some Muslim families, you might say in the majority, I don't know. But I'm going to endorse some of what you're saying. I love arguing with you. I never win. It's one of the reasons I love arguing with you. I win a lot of arguments. I need to lose from time to time, and I never win with you. But I'm going to just say this. I think you're really onto something very important. I'd love to see you write about this a bit more, Kev, because you're an amazing writer. You're right, because there are a number of alt-right commentators that have popped up out of nowhere in the last couple of years, and they spend an inordinate amount of time decrying the fact that there's a mosque coming to a town near me or whatever, right? Now, I'm not saying that I totally disagree with these people. I can see why they're upset about these things, and I have my sympathy, and I do interview them, I do bring them on this program as well, and I do challenge them, but I understand it. But I think you've hit on something really important. While they are decrying and moaning about, well, we're seeing more Muslims in our cities than we ever did before, and oh, there's a mosque being built, oh, this is terrible, they're invading and our culture is being marginalised. And again, I have some sympathy for that feeling. I also have to acknowledge what you just said is true. They don't want to talk about the fact that their own churches, whichever denomination it is, whether it's Catholic or Protestant or whatever, attendances have been dwindling for years, Kevin. People have been turning away in droves from organised religion. Christians have. And I believe there are many, many, many reasons, many nuanced reasons for this. In Ireland, I think abuse by the clergy of children, massive, of course. I cover this in my time in mainstream media. But I think you've hit on something really, really, really important. I think they're screaming about the fact that mosques and Muslims and all that, and they're talking about our culture is being eroded. But even if the mosques weren't there, and even if the Muslims weren't there, adherence to Christian doctrine is dwindling, Kevin. Anyway, you can't blame the Muslims for that, I would say. And I have said this to some of these people, and they just don't have the answer to that. They say, well, that's irrelevant anyway. We are being supplanted by, we are being erased by this massive influx of migrants. And, of course, I will ask, why are they fleeing Syria, Afghanistan, Libya, parts of Africa? Why are they doing that? Well, it might be because their towns and villages have been bombed into oblivion, maybe. But I think you've hit the nail on the head there. We don't have those values. I thought of you, actually. I did a monologue the other day about a young woman, Miley Cyrus. Miley was on stage at Glastonbury the other day, Kevin, and was simulating having sex with a microphone, oral and vaginal. And children were seeing that. And I thought to myself, I must be getting very old now. But I thought there's something very, very wrong with that. I don't think you can blame Christianity for that. But I looked at it and I thought, what's happening here? Why is that going on? Why am I watching a live music concert at 6 o'clock in the afternoon and a young woman is simulating sex with a microphone and nobody seems to be too bothered by it? I'm guessing in various Muslim communities, that just would not be tolerated, or it wouldn't happen.
Yeah, it's just like the world I was born into in 1959.
Yeah,
Such things would never have been tolerated in public then. And so I think a lot of these people who are so upset about Islam really should look in the mirror and look at their own culture. And if you're unhappy that your white European culture is dying out because women are averaging about one child per woman, which is a complete demographic implosion, maybe you need to get some values back that would lead people to marry and have children and make the immense sacrifices necessary for that, and to do it properly and to do it well and productively and have it work in general. You need to restrict sexuality to within marriage. That's what marriage is. Throughout all human cultures, it's a way of restricting sexuality so that the hormone-addled young men are forced to use their energy to protect and nurture the women and children. That's, marriage was invented by women and children to harness that rapacious sexual energy of men, and that it's no longer harnessed. It's all over the place, and it's fun and games, but the family is gone now in the West. And I don't blame these white nationalists for freaking out, but they're completely barking up the wrong tree when they blame Islam. They should be joining Islam. They should, as Christians, they can come to the mosque. They can pray five times a day with us Muslims. You're welcome to come to the mosque. Learn how to pray properly. Come and pray with us. You can pray to the one God with us, and you don't even need to change your Christian belief system one iota. Okay, I suppose when we recite the surah that says that God is not the Father, maybe you would disagree with that. Just like when I go to a Christian church and I hear that Jesus is God, it kind of rubs me the wrong way. So there's a couple of things like that. But basically what we do in the mosque is we pray to God. There's only one God, the creator of everything, just like you Christians do. There's no reason why you shouldn't be in the mosques with us. There's no reason why you shouldn't share our values and why you shouldn't start having children and having good marriages and good families like we have. Why don't you work with us instead of hating on us?
Yeah, there are still millions and millions of people around the world, white people, who live properly. How dare I use the term live properly? But they live according to the code of decency that you just described there. It's not gone completely, I wouldn't imagine, from, you know, white Christian communities. There are still people who bring their children up, you know, respectfully. There are still people who teach their children the right way, or the decent way, the humanitarian way. I'll tell you what's very interesting, Kevin, about that. Maybe Muslims and Christians are going to be brought together by this horrible gender politics agenda that we see emerging now in schools in England and elsewhere around the world. It's interesting that, you know, in Birmingham, obviously, I know you know about this story, we see conservative Christians standing alongside Muslims because they are absolutely, in my opinion, completely right to be outraged at what the school system wants to teach their 4 and 5 year old children, which is to teach them about sexual relationships, not only between same-sex couples, but they want them to think about relationships full stop. They want them to start talking about and thinking about the fact that even though they have a penis or a vagina, they might not be a boy, they might not be a girl. Isn't it interesting that I find it fascinating as an atheist, you know, somebody who doesn't believe in a benevolent creator. I find it amazing that these two different thoughts, these two different ideologies are coming together to unite against a common enemy. And the common enemy, Kevin, is a clear and present danger, a clear and present threat to the well-being of children, Kevin. Isn't it fascinating? Coming together against that.
Well, I'm surprised there isn't more of that, especially here in the U.S. And I'm actually a bit ashamed of my own Muslim community here in the U.S., which has been slow to stand up on these issues and other issues. 9/11, for example, the vast majority of American Muslims know 9/11 was a false flag, yet very few are doing anything at all about it. And likewise, very few are in any way active in trying to push back against this bizarre, you know, 38 genders and pronouns, and this crazy attempt to confuse us, and especially to confuse our children about these issues. It seems like the Christians are a little bit ahead of the Muslims here in the U.S. on that, which is kind of surprising because Islam has very clear traditional teachings on this that have been well preserved and are still there, and you'll find them in any mosque. But maybe Muslims here are just too intimidated. 9/11 whipped up so much Islamophobia that Muslims have retreated into their shell. And I think that's cowardly, and that's not emulating the Prophet, peace upon him, and the companions and family who were some of the bravest people ever who stood up under vastly more difficult conditions for what was right. So I hope the other American Muslims here in the United States will stand up for what's right and join those Christians who are working to preserve the family values that, you know, are not only part of Islamic tradition, but also American tradition.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because when I talk about this particular subject, I will get an email or two from a gay man or a lesbian woman, and they will say, right, I understand your reticence, Richie, when it comes to this new curriculum in schools, but where's the harm in explaining to children that in the world you're about to inherit, there are different types of relationships. There are men who get together and there are women who get together. Is there an argument to be made that if the school left it at that and said, look, children, there are different types of relationships, okay, there are people who strongly believe that man and women were meant to come together to marry and to procreate and build a life and build a family, and there are other people who don't believe that, and there are people who are in same-sex relationships. To be fair, what's the harm in just giving children that information?
Well, I think, actually, Richie, I think the way it was done in the past was better, which is that these kinds of issues are really for families to discuss with their own children. They're not issues that children should all be brainwashed with the same message about in a public school. You know, we all do have different values these days. It's true. And I've known many, you know, gay people. And so I used to live in San Francisco for a while. I lived at 18th and Castro in San Francisco, the epicenter of the whole world.
Yeah.
And so I've seen that. And I've had gay friends. And the way I see it, and I think the way Islam sees it, is that actually having any form of sex with anybody of any gender outside of marriage is sinful. And perhaps homosexuality is a little bit extra sinful. We have verses about Lut or Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah and so on. But in any case, it's a sin. It's like drinking alcohol. It's like stealing. You know, it's a sin in for us. And
having sex outside marriage. Having sex outside marriage is a sin. But gay and lesbian people, they're damned either way, aren't they? Because Muslims wouldn't support the marital union of same-sex couples. I know conservative Christians don't either. So gay folks are like, well, look, we are what we are. We live our lives. We don't bother anybody. We just want the same protections under the law as everybody else. So why don't you religious zealots just mind your own bloody business? That's what they say.
Yeah, I think their paradigm is wrong. I think the paradigm in the Islamic world is much more in line with reason and with what we know about human nature from anthropology. And what that paradigm says is that there's no such thing as a gay person or a straight person. All humans are entirely capable of sexual behavior and gratification with their own sex, with other sexes, probably with animals as well. And yet we all harness our sexual desires and limit them tremendously. You know, frankly, most, you know, 18-year-old men walking down the street in summer here in the United States looking around are, would, you know, what their sexual desire is to immediately jump on, you know, any one of the 50,000, 100,000 young, scantily clad women that are walking by on the sidewalk. Yet they don't do that. We, you know, as William Blake said, right, you know, better to strangle an infant in his cradle than to nurse an unsatisfied desire. Well, if you act that way, you're going to commit rape several hundred times a day. So obviously we're not made to gratify all of our desires. Nobody does. Most of us have to not act on, you know, 99.999999% of all desires, not just sexual ones, but all desires. We're constantly feeling these little desires flitting up in our consciousness. So the notion that there's such a thing as a gay person who cannot resist this, what we regard as a sinful desire, is ludicrous. It's like saying that there are people who can't resist alcohol, and so then they define their identity by that. Okay, there are people who can't resist alcohol. It's true, but that doesn't mean that our society has to normalize that and tell children that they should be that way. We have, you know, the
which
basic
is not what I said. Which is not what I said. Now, Kev, hang on a second. This is very interesting. That's not what I said. Look, first of all, you know, I respectfully disagree with that. I think people are born. There is a minority of people born, and they grow up attracted to members of the same sex, and they want to build a life with another man or another woman, and they do that. And I'm entirely supportive of that. Personally, I agree with you that children shouldn't be told what to do. I wouldn't want any encouragement of young children to be anything. But what I was saying earlier on was, I would accept schools introducing a very basic concept to children and leaving it at that, not elaborating on it, but just saying, look, there are people around you that are different. There are people who are, there are men who live with men, and there are women who live with women, and leave it at that. I could support that. I'm sickened by what is going on in schools. It's dreadful, and it's part of some very dark agenda, I believe, again, to maybe, you know, eventually get us to some situation where there's just one sex. It's crazy. You know, you can choose between 56 different genders now and all this nonsense, and, you know, children are being encouraged when... I heard a brilliant interview with a lady on BBC Radio the other day, and she was talking about being a tomboy, and she was saying, I was a tomboy. Now they're interfering with a young girl who likes to hang with the boys and play boys' games and play baseball and softball and all that, and, you know, she's a girl. Now they want to maybe consider that, oh, maybe she needs to be on treatment, maybe blockers, maybe puberty blockers, because she might be a boy trapped in a girl's body. That's all crazy, insane, dark stuff, Kevin. You might say it's satanic. Maybe you wouldn't, but I know a lot of Christians think it's satanic. And I worry about that. So those Muslims and conservative Christians who gather in Birmingham to say, look, enough is enough, I completely support them. But just saying to a child, you know, look, there are... It comes in different ways. And be aware of it. It's out there in the world. And, you know, that's... Maybe I could... If that's the way it was taught, maybe... I could support it, but of course that isn't the way it's being taught. Anyway, back to you. I kind of went a million miles around, skirted around the point I wanted to make there, but that's the point I would have made. Don't tell them you should be this or you should be that, but just let them know there are many different ways that people have relationships.
Well, I wouldn't be horrifically opposed to hearing you, you know, tell your children that. I do think, though, that it would make more sense to talk about love and to emphasize love. And there's certainly nothing wrong with love between people of the same sex. And if we talk about it that way, that's okay. I think, you know, I do think that we always have to teach children about sexuality in such a way that admits that there is this natural human struggle to control our sexuality, and that ultimately it mostly has to get channeled into reproduction. And that's what the sacred institution of marriage is all about in almost every human culture. And so that, I think, should be the normative teaching. But whether some people want to go beyond that and they have, you know, post-religious ideologies or these, you know, the modern atheistic ideologies that would part with the great tradition of almost all civilizations, that's their business, I suppose. But I think those of us who still adhere to the great religious traditions don't want this sort of thing in the schools. We would rather have the opportunity to have this discussion with our children at home, according to our own values, And if we're not going to go into the schools and force everybody to agree with us that all forms of active homosexuality are sinful, and we're not allowed to teach that, then the other side shouldn't be allowed to teach things to our children that we consider horrible and sinful.
I would agree with you 100%. Ultimately, I'm being the devil's advocate, but ultimately I agree with you. I think it's the place of the parents to talk about these things with children. And I think a really good parent will bring this up usually when a child proffers a question. It's a wonderful thing if a child says, "Dad or Mom, why are those two girls holding hands over there?" My answer would be, Kevin, as an atheist or an agnostic, I'm not sure what I am, my answer would be very brief and would say, they're together. They're in a relationship. And I would leave it at that. Let the child think whatever the child wants to think thereafter. Let's finish today where we came in. Fascinating chat today, Kevin, by the way. Thanks very much. I can throw anything at you. You've always got a well-informed response. I want to go out the way we came in, because you talked about Mahathir bin Mohamad, the Prime Minister of Malaysia. There's another reason to like this man, particularly for me, because it's an issue very close to my heart. Last year, he put forward the legislation to abolish capital punishment in Malaysia, didn't he? And I'm absolutely thrilled about that.
Yes, he's a very forward-looking man. And of course, there are some Muslims who believe that capital punishment is necessary. But I think Mahathir bin Mohamad is following the real Islamic tradition of using our reason. Yes, we look at scripture, at revealed scripture, but that revealed scripture repeatedly tells us to use our reason and to think things through. And I think he does a pretty good job of that. And so I'm with you on that. This is another thing I admire about him.
Yeah, I was thrilled about that. Yeah, one of the conversations we've had in the past, I spend a lot of time in my teens writing to people on death row, and mostly in America, and I've always hated the thought of it. It makes me sick. I'm 44 years old now, and I still can't watch a documentary which contains an interview with a man in a 6 foot by 4 foot usually cell, where he spends 23 hours a day for years before he's injected like a rabid dog and put to death. I absolutely hate it. Listen, thanks for coming back on the program today, mate. Love having you on. You know that. It's been brilliant having you on. Fascinating to hear your travels in Malaysia and all the rest of it. People can go to truthjihad.com to find out more about Kevin and the broadcast there and the writing, Veterans Today, and everything else. You know you're welcome back anytime. Don't leave it so long before you come back, Kev. Thanks so much. And do say hello to Rabia for us as well, by the way.
I sure will, Richie. Thanks so much. And she says hi to you too.
Cheers, mate. Thanks for that. The brilliant Kevin Barrett, live on the Richie Allen Show for Wednesday, July 3rd, 2000. Kevin, while you're still there, happy Independence Day, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you. The dogs are terrified as the explosions
I know,
are going off.
The dogs,
turning into a war zone.
That's right. When it's Guy Fawkes here, our dog as well, she's terrified. But I forgot to mention 4th of July tomorrow. Cheers, mate. Thanks for that. The brilliant Kevin Barrett live on your Richie Allen Show, Wednesday, July 3rd. It's coming up for 9.5 minutes to the top of the hour. Loads of tweets on various aspects of that conversation. We covered a lot of ground there. Right, I'm going to play out with a couple of tunes. It is stiflingly warm in the studio here, and I can't do very much about that. I can't yet put in air conditioning. I plan to do something like that for the months of July and August, particularly, of course, maybe early September. And I can't use a fan. I've not got a quiet enough fan, but it's been very warm these last few days. Even if the temperature outside isn't exactly boiling, it's been very warm inside the studio, so I'm going to get out of here. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9:30 with Thursday's newspaper review programme. That's on YouTube, my YouTube channel, youtube.com. Until then, big shout out again to Tony Gosling, thisweek.org.uk, The Politics Show, BCFM, and to Kevin Barrett, you just heard there, truthjihad.com. An absolutely amazing guy is Kevin. You can leave tweets for me at any time. On Twitter, it's at Richie Allen Show, of course, on Twitter. Leave tweets for me at any time with suggestions for guests or anything else. I'll be delighted to hear any of those. Got a nice old U2 song before they were groomed, or Bono was groomed even, by Bill Clinton. I'm going to go out with a song called All I Want Is You from the album Rattlin' Hum from 1988, I think. All right. Look after yourselves and one another. Speak tomorrow at 9:30. Bye now.